So, I should thank the organizers for the chance to speak, and I'll take the chance not to speak about string theory. So please don't give me such a hard time. I'm just trying my luck with cosmology. Anyway, I'm speaking about De Sitter holography, so it's certainly string inspired, and the CMB. The things I say is about two papers, one with Rob Lee and Peter van der Schaar, was about a year ago, and then a recent one with Bob McNeese, which is actually more or less where the stuff I say is coming from. So let me start with some motivation. As I guess David Wands was instructing us, what are the questions? Well, we want a theory of the very early universe, which somehow resolves the initial singularity. I don't know how to do that, so I'll try to instead circumvent the question and say that this is not the right question to ask. We should ask a different question, which we might be able to answer. So the strategy I'm after is to develop De Sitter CFT correspondence. In other words, follow more or less the kind of thoughts that have been advocated very strongly by Andy Strominger, but also developed by a number of other people, including people here. Namely, that the very early universe should somehow be mapped to a system with no gravity. So this quantum difficult quantum gravity problem might become a different problem in a quantum field theory. So that's the holographic idea. The vision in the strongest form would be that the very early universe, which is sort of supposed to be an inflationary space-time, there's some inflationary epoch in our 4D space-time, it was approximately De Sitter, some quasi-De Sitter phase, and the holographic sort of vision in the strongest form, the thing that we don't have, but which we hope to get someday, would be that that's related to some quantum field theory in three Euclidean dimensions. So the holographic direction is time. So the four-dimensional space-time might be related to some 3D, theory. Yes?
I guess this whole picture assumes that De Sitter space is a sort of fundamental vacuum of the theory.
Oh, yes.
I mean, unlike these metastable examples given.
Maybe. So this, yeah, I mean, so the spirit of this, the attempts of trying to do this kind of thing microscopically is that, yes, there are S-brains or whatever, and that these things do much like what regular deep brains do, several ifs and buts, very big ones right there. But, well, that's the vision. And then I'll say what I'll actually do, which...
Necessarily, I don't think so. So in the inflationary case, right, it would be like an Archic flow as you probably
yes?
described. So there, the Sitter is certainly not stable.
Ah. But that's right. So that's right. You're right.
Some of what he says will be applicable to unstable.
Right. That's right. No, and that's important.
I mean, just, stability in the context of ADS is somehow subtle, right? Because in ADS, like in ADS CFT, for example, you could imagine having a minimum that is deeper than the ADS minimum that you're looking at. Mm. However, you don't have valid ones.
Yeah, no, thing. I mean, it's not completely hopeless, merely difficult. So my thoughts on the subject are very much inspired by the specific features of the cosmic microwave background. So the standard story of the CMB is that, well, there's an inflationary epoch, and it's nearly De Sitter. Now, if it was De Sitter, there would be a spectrum of cosmic microwave background, which would be scale invariant. Since it's not exactly De Sitter, it's nearly De Sitter, this spectrum will be nearly scale invariant. Now, the way I'm going to interpret that fact from inflation is that there should exist some sort of scale invariant fixed point theory which governs this system, and the CMB should be described as perturbation theory around this fixed point. So that's just a description of what we think are facts. Now, there are two directions to go, though. One is very strong to try to interpret those things. One is to say, well, this inflationary fixed point is in universality class with a completely different kind of theories, and simply the universality class of some three-dimensional Euclidean quantum field theory close to its sort of RG fixed point. That's the holographic conjecture, is that that is true. You know, I don't know if it's true, but that's the holographic conjecture.
I'm sorry, you're referring to that as the holographic conjecture.
Yes.
That's one
holographic. Oh, no, sure.
Another one might be that the degrees of freedom are associated with Isaac and are not based on the Euclidean theory, but real.
You're absolutely right. So I'm referring to that this is my sort of interpretation I'm after, and then the holographic version of reading this is that the theory we're looking for is a three-dimensional theory.
Three-dimensional, but not necessarily Euclidean, not necessarily
one. Sure. Fair enough. But Euclidean.
But it could be. I'm just saying
yeah.
that is a no. strong
assumption. No, you're right. You know, but I wanted to say just early on, just also, I mean, particularly for cosmologists and so, that in a certain sense, there's a weaker proposal, that's slightly less concrete, but, well, unlike this one, which might very well be wrong, I think, it has a bigger chance of being true, that the weaker proposal would be that, well, let's just imagine the gravity, of which we don't understand a lot, but gravity in the infrared, what I'm imagining is that at long distances, it simply describes our universality classes in much the way, same way as quantum field theories are in the UV. Now, this could be via holographic correspondence, but it could also just be something that's separately true. And it's something that I think one should think about. And that I think, it's just something that might be interesting. If that's true, that would be relevant for the CMB. It would be useful and would also be relevant and interesting for the dark energy. I would say that would be equivalent to inflation. It's a different way of stating this sort of same kind of assumption. So that's the visionary stuff. Let me outline the actual talk. So I'm going to define a holographic map in quite close analogy with ADS-CFT, just by following step by step and say, what does it take? And what we get is a prescription which works. It's a prescription in the sense that it works as a computational scheme for actually computing things that are of interest. Now, what it is not, just to make sure that I don't overstate the case, is that this is not something that has microscopics. I'm not deriving this. I'm just giving a computational scheme. So I'm taking sort of an effective field theory, low energy kind of point of view. You know, I should also emphasize, just because a lot of people, I do think, looked at DS-CFT sort of when it was, you know, fashionable a couple of years ago. This scheme is slightly different, actually, from the scheme that was popular back then. For example, the scheme that Strominger and many of his students, who are now postdocs here, were doing. This is a slightly different version of it. and this version is basically due to Juan. But it's closely related, obviously. And this version, in many ways, is very conservative. This is basically a reformulation of what cosmologists already do. It's cosmological perturbation theory reorganized. So in that way, it's very conservative and something that I think is separate interest. So anyway, first story, about half the talk, or at least half, is just to define that map. How does it work computationally? Then the second part is applications to cosmology. The end of this thing is basically recover the standard predictions for the cosmomicrograph background. And then try to discuss that in sort of more holographic, visionary terms and say, how is it that we might actually have some added value now that we've covered what we normally get? Might we have some added value from this point of view? And I think we have at least a little bit of value added. So to set up some of the mechanics of this, let me remind you of a very simple thing from classical mechanics, basically, Hamilton-Jacobi theory. It's a natural setup for semi-classical treatment of many systems. And it's standard in many ways in cosmology. So let me just look at a simple classical mechanics system, just to remind you what this thing is. So a single degree of freedom, Q. It has some Lagrangian, depends on Q and Q dot, and time, explicitly time, perhaps. So the action integral is this. Now, what the Hamilton-Jacobi functional is the same as the action. But is action interpreted in a very special way? We interpret, of course, we integrate over time when we compute our action. But we have some final time t. The action, the Hamilton-Jacobi functional, is the action written as a function of that final time t and as a function of what q is at that time. So we lose a dimension in this functional, and the way we do it is that we evaluate the action on shell. We enforce the equation of motion, that's how we lose a dimension, and then we consider the action as functional of that final data. Okay, that's a prescription, a mathematical prescription. It's a very useful thing to solve a number of mechanical problems. Let me just evaluate one feature of this just to sort of get the memory going. Let me take the variation of this functional with respect to the coordinate q. Well, when you vary, first of all, the Lagrangian in here, basically, you vary with respect to q and q dot. The q dot variation, you'll integrate by parts. And that way, you get a boundary integral. When you're done, the bulk integral will be proportional to the equation of motion. That's what we're normally interested in our variational principle. But when we do Hamilton-Jacobi formalism, what we're interested in is not so much this thing in here, which is the equation of motion, but rather the boundary integral. We're going to say, oh, that means our S depends on Q. And how does it depend on Q? Well, it's the derivative with respect to Q is that boundary integral, which is dl dq dot. That's a thing normally called the momentum. So the Hamilton-Jacobi functional has a derivative with respect to the dynamic coordinate, which is the momentum.
So this is a very simple question. Why is S not a function of P
dot? It's a functional of Q at a given time.
But then pick out the solution, don't you give me Q and Q dot?
No. There's one piece of data missing, which I'll say in a second. Yeah, that's right. That's right. There's an initial here, which left unspecified. So it's a piece of data that went in that I didn't tell you about, but I will on the next transparency. Yeah. Okay, so why is this useful or interesting? Well, this links up to semi-classical ideas about quantum mechanics. If you take a semi-classical wave function, psi, and write sort of ESIS, then you know very well that the quantum mechanical momentum operators act like derivative with respect to Q, and we see that that's really the way we found the momentum up here. So it turns out, and this sort of reminds us of that fact, that the Hamilton-Jacobi functional defined this way really is, in a certain precise sense, the phase of the semi-classical wave function. So we can think about it as a direct way to get into quantum mechanics, at least in a semi-classical approximation. This works throughout. If you compute, instead of just computing the momentum as I did here, but try to compute the time derivative, well, you'll find it essentially gives the Hamiltonian, and that this really is nothing but the Schrodinger equation written for a wave function of this form. So the Hamilton-Jacobi equation is an equation for this functional S, and it's a function. It's the equation that you would call the Schrodinger equation if this was quantum mechanics, but I really think about it just as classical mechanics. And then, and just treat it as classical mechanics, basically. So that's Hamilton-Jacobi theory. I'm going to apply that, of course, not for a single quantum mechanical degree of freedom, but rather a full scale of field. And at least for the beginning of this talk, I'm just going to take some scale of field phi, the inflaton, think about it as a spectator scale of field. In other words, I'm going to consider a background space, which is just the sitter. I'm not going to allow my scalar field to back react on it for now. I'm going to take the sitter space that looks with a metric like this. This tau here is the conformal coordinate, which is a useful way to write it. Note that tau is actually a negative number, so that when it approaches zero from the negative side, that is what it means to get towards the future. So tau moves in the right direction, but it's always a negative number. So what we have is an action, which has a phi in it, of course, just a canonical phi, with some scale, with some potential, and it's a four-dimensional action. Now, we're then going to do the same thing as we did for Hamilton-Jacobi function. We're going to consider that as function of its boundary data at the future time surface. So it's a function of what time that future time surface is, and of what phi of x is there at that surface. Now, of course, comes the question about the missing data, the phi dot. Well, we need a boundary condition, and that is basically at the early time. It's natural to take that at the early time, so minus infinity time, the conformal time. And we're going to insist that the action is finite, that the integral, when I try to integrate towards the tau equal minus infinity, is convergent. That's the natural boundary condition, certainly from the point of view of the wave functional interpretation of this, is to say that we have a finite, a well-defined quantum mechanical probability back at that time. The physics is that what we do is we take the Euclidean continuation, basically, early times, and that has to be regular. If that's regular, that is what will guarantee that the action was finite back then. So that is what amounts to putting the system in the best thing we know as basically saying the ground state at that early time, and then evolve forward.
But the momenta are infinitely blue shifted.
The momenta are infinitely blue shifted. I don't think I understand. Yes. So we put all our oscillators at zero. What? And then as we move towards the future, that what used to be nothing might now become something. And so as you move backward, you said you.
You have to make your assumptions about the vacuum, the ground state, the neutral state, in this situation in which everything is infinitely shifted.
Yeah. I don't think I quite understand. I mean, this is the standard boundary condition that we do in inflation, right?
Is the equals to zero at tau equals minus infinity.
Yeah, that's true.
For example, what you do about the U V tunnel? I guess this is
that we will get to. That we will get to. Yeah, so there's a story, which last time I was at ITP I talked about, how exactly did we choose the vacuum. I think it's unique. I think the Euclidean vacuum is exactly the right thing to do and the only thing that's UV definite. But okay, that story is not the one I think we should discuss. I'd really rather not do it. There's been a discussion, as you know, in the literature about how exactly to do this. I do now what is standard and long established in cosmology. And it is interesting to think about whether one should do something else. And one could incorporate that in this formalism if one should so decide.
The vacuum of this
acid. Yeah, I take the standard acidic vacuum. Other choices are interesting, perhaps. This choice amounts, from the point of view of the path integral, I should say, is that this patch I have, these coordinates here, which is basically the standard cosmological coordinates, they only cover half of the sitter. So this amounts to regularity along this horizon, if you will, the past horizon. So regularity along that. Of course, in the Euclidean plane, that horizon here is just a point. So it really is just regularity at a single point. But just in many DSCFT discussions, of course, it's important to have everything, and that I do not have. So, yes?
I have another question. You can really look only at the scalar field.
Yes.
Then it means you neglect two things. You neglect gravitational waves, and you neglect the coupling of the perturbations of phi to the scalar.
Yes. I will take those things into account in due course. This is just for pedagogical reasons. That would amount to being in a different state than the one I chose.
And there's something wrong with that, or?
I'm saying that's not the state we started in, and there's nothing.
That's a choice.
That's a choice, yeah. That's a choice. And as I say, that's an interesting discussion about how about different choices. Does it lead to late time effects? Yes, it does. And that's interesting. Okay. So now I want to emphasize that this an analogy with ADS-CFT. So here I'm trying to say that the semi-classical wave function of this system here, which is just taking this S, take the exponential of it, and say that's the wave function of the universe, if you will, at late times. Now, this is very, very similar to what we actually are very familiar with in ADS-CFT, where we consider a dual theory on the boundary, on a spatial boundary, spatial infinity, but say in ADS-5 we go to spatial infinity, and we define our field on that boundary, and we compute the effective action for that theory, basically, from a gravitational point of view, by integrating out the bulk and setting the bulk on shell. That's how we get our gravitational wave functional. So if you were to identify this psi here with the generating functional of the correlator, so some dual theory, then this is what the ADS-CFT prescription is. I'm not going to take that full step yet, but you see now that this here, it really is a formalization of what would be standard in ADS-CFT. It's just doing things along a time direction, and there the Hamilton-Jacobi formalism is the standard way of doing this.
So the boundary is supposed to be the upper?
That's the boundary. This is where the theory is. That's right. Or perhaps a little bit down at a constant tau. But that's right. It's analogous to the Euclidean ADS. No, if you do the Lorentzian ADS. Yes, but in Lorentzian ADS, so in ADS-CFT we normally go to the Euclidean ADS, and it's the Euclidean ADS where we say that all our bulk wave functions has to be regular at the origin, right? That's a prescription we get for wave functions.
Okay, that paper just looks analogous to the Poincaré path.
And then
other boundary conditions.
Yeah, it does, but I mean, it is just like what we normally do. I put in regularity, which was the same that we normally. I mean, I could consider putting excitations there, yes. And okay, so let me talk about a feature of this action. So let's take a massive scalar field, just a free scalar field, and compute explicitly the Hamilton-Jacobi action for that. So what we have is we compute from minus infinity up to some tau. Some action here, which is the free action. I put in this decoupling to the metric, but as Gabriele pointed out, it's just static. Now I integrate by parts. The bulk action will disappear because this field phi actually solves this equation of motion. So there'll just be a boundary action, phi phi dot from having a phi phi prime by having integrated by parts here. And then the equation of motion term, which vanishes. Now we need to evaluate this. It depends not just on phi on the boundary, but also on phi prime. We don't want that. I want it as function of phi. So what I need to do is that I need to solve the equations of motion and find phi prime as a function of phi. That I can do. This is just a free equation of motion, of course. I can just find what is the solution. There's some solution, some power law of tau. There's another power law of tau, and this is the solution with either of these two exponents. Then I impose, as I insisted on, regularity at very early times. That amounts to throwing away this solution here, because that solution would have an infinite action at very early times, and I've said that I don't want. So I have to evaluate this thing here on that solution, and that's how I managed to express phi prime in terms of phi. And then I have the functional in terms of the variables I want. Basically, it's phi squared, but with some coefficient that now depends on my tau, because basically my derivative with respect to tau brought down a 1 over tau. So what I have is this action here. I've written it not in terms of phi, as I should have, but just in terms of my tau variables. The C minus here I should have exchanged for phi. But I do that because I'm going to try to evaluate this. Now, we want to go towards the future boundary. Well, this thing diverges towards the future boundary. Basically, because I chose regularity early on, it will diverge towards the future. We were familiar with this kind of thing from ADS, and many of us are also from De Sitter, that this is just what you have to deal with. Yes?
I'm sorry, because the phi prime was essentially determined by the fact that you know phi at t, and you also knew phi back at t equals minus infinity.
Right.
In some sense.
Yes. So that goes away by regularity. I knew it early on.
Right.
Therefore, this is phi. I know how to take the derivative with it, with respect to it. Basically, it gets 1 over tau times phi with some factor, lambda minus over tau.
So that's how. You have x dependence in phi, but you don't.
Yeah.
Generically, yeah, that's right. So I just took a homogeneous scalar, but generically, absolutely, and I will.
And if you did include the x dependence, this would be a very phi prime would be a very non-local function of phi.
Yes.
Right? So it would be a very complicated.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, very doable. I mean, this is a power law. I'm very good at differentiating powers, but Bessel functions I can do as well. Although with less ease. So anyway, this means that the Hamilton-Jacobi functional, as defined, it diverges at the future surface, and that's a problem that we need to deal with. Now, I should emphasize that this is a divergence which is infrared in character. As tau goes to zero, so as we sort of take time towards the future, then that amounts, in fact, to all the wavelength, the co-moving, the physical wavelengths, to become very large. So, in one way to look at it is if I actually took something that did depend on k, as was proposed, wave function would depend on k tau. So taking tau to zero, I might as well take k to zero. So k to infinity. Well, it's the long wavelength limit. And this means that this divergence we're talking about here really is infrared in character. And that means it's not something that we ought to be very scared of. It's not something that we think we know how to deal with, although there may be some disputes about how exactly to deal with it. Now, these local divergences, I think, are very important. And we developed a little bit more of a theory for them, just to express a little more generally what they are and what their nature is, and then to deal with them. So instead of just doing, as I did, a homogeneous scalar field, which was the simplest thing I could do, and in fact, homogeneous free scalar field, which was just for illustration, let me take a much more general case where I have a general potential and where I allow k dependence if I want. Let's take some solution. Now, I want to find the divergence in that case, that completely general case. What do I do? Well, what I'm trying to solve for is the Hamilton-Jacobi functional. The Hamilton-Jacobi functional, as I mentioned, satisfies a Hamilton equation, basically. Now, you can rewrite that in terms of just some variations acting on the Hamilton-Jacobi functional. This is the general Hamilton-Jacobi function. Some spatial derivatives, there's some phi derivatives, and this is what it couples to, as computed on a single surface. This is just a Hamiltonian constraint. In fact, I have now, because that is what I wanted to eventually, I have actually included gravity, because I think this is more natural to talk about Hamiltonian constraints in that case.
Actually, sorry.
Yes?
A bit of a side point, but is what you're doing right now any different than just doing field theory in De Sitter space with certain boundaries?
No, but I'm interested in that particular piece.
Right, okay.
That infrared divergence you normally, I don't think, pay attention to.
Okay.
It's normally a pure phase, right?
So yeah, that's also true. That's right.
What is a pure phase?
This divergence. It's an e to the is, and it's a real part of s that diverges. So I might decide that it's not important. To try to solve this equation, which is in general, of course, complicated, is the general potential, and I have curvature and everything, let me make a derivative expansion. So let me try to say that the field S could be written, perhaps, as a local functional on the boundary, as some function of phi. There's some derivative terms, perhaps. If I have gravity, I also have a boundary curvature, which would come with some coefficient, and plus dot, dot, dot. So I could have higher derivatives. So I can try to make such an ansatz and plug that into this equation and try to solve, at least, and get an approximation for that S here. That's not a hard thing to do. It gives certain nonlinear differential equations, but they're not that hard. The U function here, the leading part of the divergence, is given by a very simple expression. It's equal to up to numerical coefficient minus 2. It's simply what is normally called the Hubble parameter. It's H of phi. So in this, if this was the sitter, real the sitter, H would just be a constant. Now what we have in mind is that we're going to have some scalar field that's sort of slowly rolling down, so H depends mildly on phi, but just mildly. And this is a function that's very simple to find. It's one that it's a well-defined function that follows from the FRW equations of the background. But what is important here is that this really is a very general expression. If phi had been a field that has spatial dependence, for example, so a complicated thing, one where it would not be so easy to actually solve the equations of motion, this is still the correct functional dependence of that leading divergence here. That leading divergence is always given by this. This is a functional relationship. So if that phi, if I really give it spatial dependence and all, I could just take this function here and still just make expansions in it. This will give the leading piece. Moreover, as I take tau goes to 0, then these higher derivative terms here, because they're being contracted with respect to the metric, and the metric itself diverges as tau goes to 0, that means this is actually an expansion in the inverse metric. These will come with higher and higher powers of tau. What that means is that there are no divergences in these extra terms, which means in this way, I can find all the divergences of a general theory for general potential V and for arbitrary spatial dependence and such. So this is a complete characterization of the divergences. So it looks very innocuous that, okay, U is minus 2H, you know, it's basically sort of redefinition of symbols, but this is a full characterization of the divergences, and that's something that we think is actually of some interest, and I'll apply it a fair bit later.
Are you using some conventional conventions?
Well, 8 pi g,
eight pi g
is 1. That was not what you were worried about. V is positive. My action was a kinetic term minus V, so I mean, you know, my H I want to be positive. Yeah, that's right. So that U here will be negative. That's right. This is U. Oh, this is not V. That's right. So this is there's a relation here between, so and that's that the derivative. You know, so U. It's a little bit of a tangent, but it's a thing you might think about as a superpotential. You might not, but but V is sort of, you know, the square, and there's some derivative stuff like that. If this had been a supersymmetric theory, then there would have been a sort of related relation that would have been to get from superpotential to potential. As you know from that case, the precise relation between superpotential and potential is not sort of completely obvious. You have to study it a little bit before it becomes second nature. And similarly with this U. Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, towards the end, that's right. That's right. It's not obvious. That's right. It's not obvious. It's not obvious. It hopefully will be, yes.
I didn't quite follow. So if you have a multiple fields, then each of them will have the same view.
Well, that I have to think about. I'm not sure, actually. I didn't try to think about that, but I don't think so, actually.
Because it's all equal to minus 2H.
Yeah, but I think I used in solving this, I used the FRW equation. The FRW equation for multiple scalar fields has a different structure. It's still doable, but I haven't solved it for this, so I'm not going to claim You see, you claim you can see on the spot what the answer is supposed to be?
No, I'm...
But I'm not claiming this equation for multiple scalar fields. I mean, I could find it, I think, but it's not obvious to me what it is. Okay, I just mentioned this. Right, I mentioned these things. These were the general divergences, and we've gotten a full functional dependence. Okay, so now I found the local part, all the divergent pieces, and have a general characterization of what they are. Now, what I want to argue is that what I should do to compute meaningfully in this theory is that I should take my full Hamilton-Jacobi functional, computed by whatever means I have at my disposal, probably in some approximation, and then I should subtract these local divergences. You see, local divergences are completely general. So no matter what solution I find, it has to be that the difference between the full solution I might find and this, you know, local piece, which is actually the divergent piece, that difference here is going to be a finite piece. It's one that actually exists as tau goes to zero. So the analogy here, if there had been a dual theory, would be that these local pieces here plays the role of counterterms. So I'd have my full action, which diverges. It's an unrenormalized action, but I subtract some counterterms. What do I get? I get a renormalized action, which makes sense. It's finite. So local theory, and in local field theory, if this really was a holographic theory, that would be very nice, because we're very used to the idea that we can subtract local counterterms. We can't subtract any counterterms. That's bad. But local counterterms are fair game. They just amount to renormalize the couplings that they are under theory. So that's what this would mean if the things were dual to a field theory. Yes?
In this case, you might need to impose the extra constraint that you need. You can only subtract imaginary things.
Yeah. You want to go to five dimensions? Yeah, you're maybe right. You may be right. Yeah. I mean, yes, that's an interesting question. And
you mean only just spaces?
Yeah. Right. So I'm claiming here that it's enough to do local theory, local subtractions, and that will subtract all divergences. And that's exactly the right thing to do. In five dimensions, one noticed that, the precise, the right rule seems to be different. It doesn't immediately generalize.
I'm a little bit confused about the physics, because you could take a finite k component of phi.
Yes.
It looks to me that this divergence of k tau goes to zero just corresponds to the standard amplification perturbation.
Yeah, but I think it amounts to them sort of diverging, I think, as you actually get way outside the horizon.
Yeah, but they do diverge.
Well.
Some inverse powers of tau. A Bessel
function. So I'm subtracting a divergence from that Bessel function.
I'm asking whether you are subtracting something physical.
I think I'm not. These are supposed to be sort of unphysical, but you'll see that actually they do control.
Why is it that you want to do this subtraction?
Okay, fair enough. So I want to compute correlators using this functional, and it would be certainly inconvenient if it diverged, and I think I might get wrong answers. But see, so there are two interpretations. One was this thing about if this was local field theory, if this was ADS-CFT, in fact, and you know, this is what I would do, and it's the right thing to do, and we're all confident. We subtract local counterterms when we do ADS-CFT, right? Now, let me try to tell it from a cosmological conservative bulk point of view, you know, no duality, anything like that. I would just say that, look, I have an action, and what I'm interested in is not actually the action of the system, it's the action of the fluctuations. It's reasonable to say that the action of fluctuations is the action of the whole minus action of the background. So I subtract, and that relative piece is what I can reasonably call action of the fluctuations, which is what I do. So that's the conservative bulk gravity, you know, this is the right thing to do.
Maybe there's a slight difference if you talk about eternal de-Sitter or if this is just like in the model with the potential that ends, say, in some radiation era. And I'm not sure that this amplification of the perturbation is unphysical.
Right, so you're talking about that you have a specific infrared completion at late tau, and that does that matter? So that's maybe. So I'll comment on that a little bit later, but I'm not going to have a complete answer to that. But yes. And I'm ignoring that at this point. Yes.
I don't mean to slow you down more than you are, but your comment suggests that there's a clean test of a DS-CFT conjecture. If you do some computation in perturbative scalar fields coupled to the de-Sitter background or perturbative gravity to consider background, and somewhat the way you would test any SCFT. You do some calculation of supergravity, and the general, it has to have a certain general form to be consistent with a local conformal field.
I would say that is a minimum test. If that worked, I wouldn't say I've established the SCFT.
There's a list
it
of
could
things.
False, it could be wrong. That's
and,
right.
And so you could compile a list of things that have not been computed.
That's right. I think that's fair game. That one could compute some higher order correlators. Those could have completely the wrong analytical structure. I imagine there probably are, if we think hard enough, general arguments that they will have the right structure, basically because they had an ADS. But
you have to write a four-point function.
There are computations that are not easy to do that I think could have the wrong analytical structure. But as Juan is saying that, well, in five dimensions, it already starts seeming, actually, it's a little bit different. You need to change the rules a little bit. And then you say, okay, but that's probably still okay. And the question is whether at some point your list of rule changes start being disturbing to you, I think. If it might be that you find something that's not right. And say, actually, I didn't mean it when I said this prescription. Actually, a slightly different prescription, you see. But at some point, I would give up. Yeah, but make your students do it. That was what I was trying to say. So
the fact that you have an ADS-CFT correspondence is a strong constraint.
Could make this work without you taking this as a sign, as a miracle.
You treat an ADS if it works, and this is an analytic continuation of that. So the implications you're discussing.
What would be the first thing that would not? Why would that not continue also?
Okay, so as was stated, I've just done scalar fields most of the time, and I really should do a better job. So let me just review this because there are string theory people who probably don't know about it, but cosmologists would say this is textbook stuff, and it is. So what I really should do is to do a scalar field coupled to gravity, do the combined thing, my preferred gauge and a quite popular one, but not the universal one, is to look at a metric that is in this gauge here, meaning that we allow perturbations of the tau component, we allow a conformal perturbation of the spatial part, but the off-diagonal parts, the sort of tau I parts, and the off-diagonal parts down here we put equal to zero. At any rate, if we choose a metric of this form, what it means is that we have not one scalar field, we sort of the fluctuation in the actual scalar field, but we also have these two metric components, so we have three scalar fields, if you will, phi and psi, the metric part, and we have this d phi there. However, I also put some metric components equal to zero, the tau I component and sort of the off-diagonal ij component equal to zero. Those corresponding equations of motion amounts to constraints on these, and in fact, there'll be exactly two constraints, so we're down to one scalar. The only catch is that it's not the one scalar that we perhaps thought we had, it's a dressed up scalar. It's not the d phi, it's one that's dressed up with these things here, a neat choice. Is that it's this particular combination, so it depends on what exactly the background phi and the background Hubble constant was, but essentially it's a difference between the scalar field we actually had and some gravitational component. That's a standard choice, and it has a nice geometrical interpretation in place as well, but I'm not going to go that way. I'm just going to say that it is this scalar field that I really mean to talk about. So it's still pretty much just what? Zeta, yes. What do you mean to imply? So that scalar field. So that Zeta satisfies some equations of motion. It's essentially the Einstein's equation, but they need to be redone a little bit to actually get the equation of motion for that zeta. But anyway, it's a second-order equation of motion, which at a first glance you might think about as pretty much a Klein-Gordon type equation. but with some extra pieces just in front of so some friction piece and some extra piece that are sort of a mass piece, if you will, that depend on exactly what background we're in. So anyway, that's a second order differential equation, pretty much like a Klein-Gordon equation, but well, it's not exactly a Klein-Gordon, it's one that's difficult to solve now. If I am in a completely general cosmological background, in a general FOW, this would be difficult to solve. These coefficient functions here would be just some general functions. So what cosmologists normally do with this is that they say, well, but I don't really want a general thing, I want inflation, which means that I'm pretty much on a slow roll, I'm more or less on a constant potential. So by making that assumption, these functions here simplify greatly. Basically, what the assumption is more precisely is that the parameters epsilon and eta, pretty much the derivative of the potential and the second derivative of the potential, both of those have to be very small. That means that I'm moving slowly down some hill. When that is the case, these functions here, they simplify greatly, and I can now solve the equations of motion. And the equation of motion become some function. Now Sean will be really horrified, but here I've spelled out that this is actually an H. This is meant to be a Hankel function. Not that we really care so much, but at any rate, it depends in some specific way on the wave number k and on the tau. And there's some index here of the Hankel function that depends on these indices up here. So there's some input that depends on exactly what background I had. But okay, I can find what that zeta is in that approximation, and then I can imagine doing it much more generally. And I can even do it, of course, a second order and stuff like that. But now that's not actually what I was interested in. What I was interested in was to find the Hamilton Jacobi functional more generally. So this renormalized action, if you will, to take the full Lagrangian with gravity piece, but also all the other pieces here. Take that piece and subtract all my local divergences. Now that's some rather general Lagrangian. But I'm interested in just the linearized fluctuations, and that means I just need to take the quadratic piece, which one can do, take the quadratic pieces of these. And then when you integrate by parts, use the equation of motion, do what I sort of did in my more pedagogical example of a free scalar field, you get this. So what do we have? Well, it still looks a little bit complicated, but it really isn't. So it's just a quadratic functional in this zeta, so it's sort of zeta squared. Well, there's some coefficients in front here. And those coefficients is actually the ones that we're after, the ones that have the interesting physics. And I'll rederive the structure of these coefficients a little bit later, and actually very soon, but in a much simpler way. Yes?
Your background continues to be near the zeta throughout the evolution?
Yes, the computation I've actually done only is valid while I'm near the zeta. And you can reasonably argue that that's not what I should have done. I should have done better. But
just different than what the cosmic microwave.
No, but it has to do now with where I put my tau also, remember? Do I actually put my tau all the way to zero, or do I put it at horizon crossing? And then this suddenly becomes exactly what you normally do.
It's different because usually you compute the spectrum of cosmic microwave background in an era where you have something which is nearly flat. So you see their end, yeah. And then it goes to something that is a
no, what you normally do is you compute this thing here, the fluctuations in these zetas, and you compute it around horizon crossing. Then you argue that actually that zeta doesn't change after that because it's actually a constant of motion in the epoch after, so I don't care about reheating and all that. And, so you did it right after all. But I didn't do that twinkle yet. So I pretended so far that I'm in a simpler situation than I am. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm using, so that's a curly H. Right, so no, H is just the Hubble constant. It's just the Hubble constant. It's just, that's the thing. One of them is respective conformal time, the other is the regular time. Sorry. And I didn't tell you, but also, do you really want to know? You know, and primes are derivative with respect to conformal time, dots are with respect to actual time. So there's a k cubed here. That was just from the phase space piece. There's an h squared, which was, yes, the other h. What? Then this here? This one here. H over phi dot. A phi prime.
The whole thing to the minus 2, right?
To the minus 2, that's right.
What's raised to the 6 epsilon minus
2? K tau naught. But this I will write in a clearer, more beautiful, bigger way on the next transparency. So, or maybe the one after that, but soon. Yes?
So if you were to think about using this kind of method for the usual calculation when you do exit inflation, how do you think about dropping this, or subtracting off this piece, the quad mode, whatever?
Oh, but what do you mean? So I would think about that the very same way, right? Or, oh, you mean if I actually ended up with all sorts of fields and matter fields and pressure and you name it? And
well, not just with fluctuation, but you're dropping that and only focusing on this difference. And
yes.
I just want to understand how you think about doing that if you're
exiting. I think about doing this, actually, the way I think about it is to have my holographic screen not really a toggle into zero, but choose a physical cutoff that's closer to the horizon crossing.
Okay.
That's the way I think about it. But let's discuss it. I have a transparency where I think where it's more natural. So now I just described an actual computation.
This, you know, is what we're saying. So when you compute the square of the wave function, it drops out.
You say it's just not relevant.
Well, it's not relevant for computing the fluctuations, but you can capture it, the cascade evolution of the system.
So the fluctuation spectrum, the thing we're actually interested in, this is what Juan has referred to a couple of times in the answers. I should have had this way earlier then. But is that since this is our wave function, what is it that we actually want to compute? Well, is, for example, to say the zeta correlation function, the two-point correlation function, right? How do we do that? Well, we take a function integral, the zeta zeta, we take the square of that, and it's the norm squared. Faces disappear. Okay, then we take the norm squared and we do it. And that we get basically the thing that was just the kernel, the thing that was in front of the psi of the zeta zeta term, get inverted. But other than that, this is the same as the stuff that was in front of the zeta zeta term. This was a Gaussian integral. So it was getting from the wave function to an actual two-point correlator, just doing a Gaussian integral.
Except that the quantum
when your H changed. Well, it became a dot at the same time. Those two particular changes. So that was why. So this is actually more transparent, probably. H is the thing that's more or less constant in the Sitter space. And so on. So this is a better expression to discuss. The power spectrum, which is the thing people are normally interested in.
Sorry, so far, that is just should be completely conventional.
This is completely conventional. I'll say that. I mean, it's the standard. This is textbook. Just didn't do it in a textbook way. I did it in a.
Actually, it is good for k tau not small,
right? K tau not small. Actually, I was going to take it of order one, actually, and
I know that that's crossing its line. That's why I'm asking.
And I think I would like to let's that too. Let's two. Yeah, that's when I approximate our Bessel functions, I took small k tau. That is also true. Yeah, no, but that's a good point. So let's comment on that. But let me just at least just for to review of the cosmology. No, I mean. And that's, of course, what you normally do, is that you take an order of magnitude after horizon crossing, and that way you get your Kagan needed too. So, but anyway, the power spectrum, which is what people normally have, is not actually the two-point function, it's how much power is there in it. So it's just multiplying by a few geometrical factors, 4 pi from the angles and some phase space factor. So this is the spectrum that people normally discuss, which is more or less scale invariant, because these H's really are constant. Phi dot is more or less constant as we roll down the hill. So it just has a mild dependence on K. The mild dependence on K is normally done in sort of how does it depend on K in this way. And this is a spectral index. And it gets some form in terms of eta and epsilon. And this is the standard textbook kind of form of being nearly scale invariant and having precise characterization of how how not scale invariant it is. And the other feature of this spectrum that's often emphasized is this thing that there's a 1 over phi dot, which means that although nearly constant, this whole thing here doesn't depend on K. But this phi dot, since it's a slow roll, phi dot is a small number, so this whole thing actually has a biggish amplitude. It's enhanced compared to what one would have gotten just for a spectator scale of field, or more precisely, what one would have gotten for tensor perturbations. But anyway, those are just the so that was the computation. So now comes the comments, how to interpret, what to do.
So if you didn't renormalize your action, would there be a change in your
answer? No, so Juan is right in saying that there was a phase. I took the normal to square, so it wouldn't, so it's the same. Yeah.
So as far as this is concerned, you didn't need
to. I think that's right. It's the right thing to do, though. and I will say, actually, why I think there's a mileage also out of doing it, because it's one of the things you can do very universally. It's a thing that governs the universal behavior, I think.
From the computational calculations, whether it's right or wrong.
True. Nope. But I think, nevertheless,
so then you come back to two transparencies. Your
two transparencies, no less.
Your action was real.
My action was. That's right. There was an I. That's right. So there was an I in that renormalized action. That exclusively came from this piece here. Basically, the time derivatives brought down some I's. And
so
because
that
there's some.
So
that got imaginary piece plus some real pieces. But many of the real pieces diverged and actually got canceled off anyway. This is a check incident also just on the whole computational scheme, of course. That, I mean, that all these Bessel functions and whatever actually did the thing that I'd claimed they should. And that's the sort of thing that makes you happy. And
the action is complex because the initial conditions were complex.
Yeah, right, right. That's right. It was a wave. It was an e to the ikx thing in the beginning, or e to minus ikt. And then a little bit later, when we took derivatives, then that became imaginary. Is it a real scalar field? Yes.
Phi was real, so zeta was real.
Yes.
So why are you taking complex?
No, but I mean, there's a quantum field, so I have an A that is multiplied by e to the minus ikx, and an A dagger with the opposite, and I say, okay, no vacuum means only the first. Okay, so I got a spectrum. Now let me discuss some issue of the cutoff. So I gave you the spectrum. This was the background data that actually has to do with what model I'm in. This was my k-dependence, which I was happy with, and I clapped my hands and thought this was great. Now, there's one issue, though, that I have my tau here, which is the cutoff. I also claimed that the whole thing was supposed to be cutoff independent, so that would appear to be a problem, that tau should simply take to zero or something like that. Well, that's not quite right, though, because the background data here actually also satisfies the FRW equations. So although they don't depend on k, they do depend on tau. To satisfy the FRW equations. That means that they're not quite constant, they're slowly varying with respect to tau, but they're mildly dependent on time. In fact, they depend on time precisely the way so as to cancel that time. So what really stands here is that there's a k dependence, but it had to be multiplied by something, and that tau took, I mean, did the dimensions right. But there is no tau dependence, despite what it might appear. So one way to think about it is that, oh, we want to remove the cutoff. We want to take tau to zero, right? So that would give a finite result. I can actually take tau to zero. Now, it was also pointed out, both Ram and Gabriella was saying that, well, of course, that would mean that there should be slow roll all the way into the future. So surely that's not what you actually want, because my computation is only valid within the slow roll. And that's true. It really isn't what I would want. What I would want is that I want to reinterpret this tau here. I've introduced it as a cutoff. But clearly, in this context here, it actually plays the role pretty much of what we normally call a physical cutoff, not the kind of cutoff that we take to infinity when we do perturbation theory, but rather the running scale that we normally take as a physical cutoff in a Wilson type of interpretation of renormalization theory. And that way, I would say that tau here, I think the way correct way to interpret it is to think about it as a physical cutoff, the one that really is set by the physical scale that is natural to my problem. And in this case, that's the horizon crossing. So I would say that the tau here really shouldn't, although things are independent of tau, so I can take it to anything, right? Except that the other approximations I've done break down a little bit later, so I'm going to choose it wisely. I'm going to choose it in such a way that it is in the middle of the energy scale where the physics actually happens, which is tau equal to 1 over ah, which is horizon crossing time. So I think that's the correct interpretation of that cutoff, actually, is that it's a true sort of running physical cutoff. So that was one comment. Another comment, which I think question sort of almost touched on, but not quite, which is one of physical observables. I've been doing de Sitter here, sort of quasi-de Sitter or whatever. Now, there's an important foundational problem in quantum de Sitter space that many people have been very bothered by, which is, what are the physical observables in this space anyway, if I want a quantum theory? What am I supposed to compute? For example, if I take my favorite square diagram here, the Kossoff diagram, and I look at two points on my future here, which is the kind of thing I've been computing, good correlation between those two points. Well, what exactly are you talking about? These X's are space-like separated. Do you actually claim that you can measure such a thing? You know, as sort of the word Witten used for that was that these correlators are not observables, they're meta-observables. If you imagine some omnipresent being knowing about everything, then yes, you could measure them, but no actual physical observer can measure this, so that's a problem. That's where the end of inflation comes in, that the modes, of course, actually re-enter the horizon. And in a way, that means that inflation really is a much better physical model for the sitter than the sitter is, in that here, these things that used to be meta-observables, they've become real observables, so we are the meta-observers. We actually can grab the things that used to be across the horizon because, well, they used to be, but they aren't anymore. So that particular problem which comes in, I mean, which is a potential problem with this type of construction, is not a problem here. I should say, though, that I haven't actually done a precise construction of this and checked, I mean, in terms of these invariants and you know, which should make it independent of reheating and all that. Okay, so I made a sort of longish derivation. I didn't give you all the details, but it was just a computation to emphasize that this is all really the same as ADS-CFT. It's almost trivial, actually, and, you know, this is just a standard story. Now let me try to get towards where I think that there might be some value added. So there are two things that I think are interesting. So one is to try to rederive everything I've done, but in a more abstract way, which I think I couldn't have done to you in the beginning, but now that sort of I've explained the framework, I can get everything in just one transparency. Now, the Hamilton-Jacobi functional, the big one, the one actually that has the K dependence, that has the full potential, all that sort of stuff, it satisfies the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. It's a horrible nonlinear equation, but anyway, it's satisfied, right? The local counter terms certainly satisfied, because that was how I actually found them, by satisfying them as tau was going to zero. Now, what that means is that we can find an equation by using these two facts for the renormalized action directly. And that action, as we try to take the cutoff to be small and basically ignore some quadratic pieces, looks like this. The renormalized action satisfies this. It obviously has some derivatives with respect to the metric. There's no surprise there. And then there's some, you know, derivative with respect to the scalar field, of course, with a coefficient. I called it beta. What is the coefficient? Well, when I actually take this Hamilton-Jacobi equation, which I wrote, which was sort of an abstract equation, I can look, what is it? Well, it's something that has to do with the counter terms, basically, because these things actually came, they started their life as squares, but one of the pieces now came from the counter term, and I knew what the counter term was. So I can derive what the beta is. It's this combination of the U. U, of course, was just some H of phi, so it's not a difficult thing to compute, and it turns out that beta is basically phi dot over H. You know, so this is a very simple computation. This is just, you know, really literally, you know, a couple of steps in the middle, I mean, here. It really should fit on one line, while some of the other stuff should have fitted on many, many transparencies. Right. So, but I do two things. So it's nonlinear for this, it's nonlinear for that, and then now I want actually the difference, and since the local terms here, they dominate as tau goes to zero only, that means I can throw away a lot of the terms. I'm only interested basically in the leading term, the one that stays finite as tau goes to zero. And that means that kills the nonlinearities. So only linear term stays. So it gives me some constraint on what this unknown function actually is supposed to be. You know, I mean, I've already computed it, so it's not that unknown. But this is a general equation, actually. Now, let me just for check go to quadratic order in this equation here. So expand these fields phi and g here. You know, do the linearized order of what the metric actually is. Say that phi is the background field plus, of course, a fluctuation. So let me expand that. Then I get this piece here for the quadratic term. I get one where basically the metric has just become the scale factor. One where this beta here is now beta as evaluated on the background. And then there's another piece when I expand it to get the fluctuation piece. That gives a derivative of phi. I call that gamma. Now, this piece here is what we'd normally call the Callan-Simancic equation. And this term here, I mean, so these gammas and betas now, is just evaluated on the background. So those basically are just some linear combinations of the epsilon and etas. So now you have a simple linear differential equation here that you can integrate up. And you can find that, oh, yes, that means that you get scale dependence in this thing here. And what is the power of that scale dependence? Well, it's sort of beta squared minus 2 gamma. Basically, this d phi itself gives a beta, so there's a beta squared and a 2 gamma. And then you take these combinations and you get back your index. So this is the whole computation in one transparency. So this is why I think paying attention to the divergences matters. The divergences have the information about how things scale when you go towards the infrared. And that's actually what we're interested in. Then it pays to pay attention to the.
Is a slow roll inflation corresponds to having a weakly relevant operator in the theory?
Weakly relevant. I infrared weakly relevant.
I mean, slow roll data in epsilon are small.
Yeah.
The amount of flow, the beta squared.
It's like in 5-4 theory. So it's so is that's an
weakly irrelevant.
Weakly irrelevant. I think it's irrelevant. That's right. I think
it's
irrelevant.
It's not marginal.
It's not marginal. It's weakly irrelevant. That's right. That's right. Marginal is scale invariant.
Yeah.
Spectrum.
Well,
scale. No. No. No.
Depends on the tilt, depends on the
So now I'm going to start being more aggressive. So at this point, I've just done sort of conservative equation, conservative computation, but let me say then.
And that was the scaling of what operator?
N sub S. With the scaling of the zeta.
Of zeta.
Zeta, that's right. I mean, so in bulk, it just has to do with how it scales with respect to K when I try to do linearized scaling, which is. It's. I'll show you in a second. So you have a CFT, which may or may not be, I mean, which could be a complicated CFT. You add an extra operator in it, you know, which makes it float, if there, so it's not a CFT anymore. Then the coupling of that operator, which is certainly close to zero, because we're just going to add it with a small coefficient.
Operator of dimension 1 plus what was it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but let me argue a little bit now that actually. That what it's supposed to be. So, astrometry pointed out, if we really want to take this into holography, then it's natural to say that the entire cosmological evolution is an RG flow. That's nice. This is a close to a fixed point. Surely that meant that there really was a flow, an entire time evolution was nothing like moving along an RG flow. So at each time, we have a three-dimensional theory, but as we move in time, what we really do is move in scale. That's his picture. Now, if you want to do that, there's something weird that happens, which you have to think through, that as time moves forward in cosmology, entropy of cosmology increases. It's called the second law, right? It increases. Now, in RG flow, to make the entropy increase, what that means is to go to the ultraviolet. In other words, sort of integrate in degrees of freedom, if you will. So moving forward in time is moving towards the ultraviolet. So moving backwards towards inflation, the origin, is moving towards the infrared. So if you want to think holographically, what you should do is that, well, for one thing, you would say, so what we really have is an infrared fixed point. That's a relatively natural thing to do. When you have sort of any theory generically, you go to the complete infrared, what do you have? Well, you have a scale invariant theory. Sometimes it's an interesting theory, sometimes it's a free theory, it's a trivial theory, but you get scale invariance asymptotically. So from that point of view, we are not surprised about getting something that's approximately scale invariant in the past. That's what's supposed to happen. A prediction of that, admittedly ambitious interpretation, but there's a prediction, which is that this fixed point now has to be a stable attractor. If this really did come about in this kind of way, it has to be obviously that I'm coming in on a fixed point line towards a fixed point. So it has to be that as tau goes to minus infinity, sort of the entire dependence here goes to zero, which means that the spectrum is going to be red. And S has to be less than 1 in order for this to disappear marginally as I go all the way into my fixed point. So the spectrum has to be red. It means that at late times, it has to be dominated by large scales. You know, it can be marginally red, but blue it cannot be. That would break this RG flow picture. So it's a discrete prediction, but, you know, what do you get these days? So what we want, just to sort of get your imagination. So it has to do with.
You were talking about the gravitational index, but here you're talking about the.
The gravitational index, huh? So it's not the whole thing, you think?
Well, you're trying to say this should decrease because central charge.
Yeah, that's right. And you're saying that's only the angiomomentum tensor that would.
Well, you perform up here, so one defines the central charge as this coefficient you're defining, but as the index of the gravitational.
It's true. It may be that I have looked at theories that are so simple that the two things are the same.
No, they're not the same.
But so I should tell you what I have in mind.
You're talking about NT.
Yeah,
NT.
No, I understand. I mean, NS is actually is dominated typically by the anomalous dimension, and in T, the tensor spectrum is by the beta function. And well, those are different things. I agree. But see, what I have in mind is this, that, I mean, so if we really had a 3D dual, so if the ambition here, I think, should be not to compute what we normally say, oh, please compute for me the inflationary potential. I'd say, no. Identify, please, not what the theory is and what the potential is, but identify what the 3D dual is, and then compute the spectra in that. So my toy model for that, just to sort of, I mean, as I say, just to get imagination going, is to say, well, look, in three dimensions, Euclidean theories, I know very nice theories that are classically scale invariant. That's a phi-6 theory. It's a very nice classically scale invariant theory. Phi-6 is scale invariant in the classical theory, but, well, if you compute quantum corrections, it flows a bit, and it's irrelevant in the infrared. And that's basically what we need. So I would say, okay, actually, the operator, the phi-6 two-point correlator, satisfies a kind of semantic equation, and well, I even know how to compute a diagram to find the lambda. It's related to the microscopic parameter G, and it's positive. I mean, that's what I said. I wanted something that was marginally relevant in the infrared, and then well, then the two-point correlator is actually, you know, it's the microscopic theory with the index being the lambda. So that's the sort of thing one has in mind. I think realistically, of course, one doesn't really expect it to be a free theory with a small perturbation. One expects it to be a complicated interacting 3D theory, and then a small perturbation around that. And that's, of course, much harder, but it's still perturbation theory, because it's around, by definition, this fixed point. So one could at least imagine that that is about as hard as a complicated question in QCD or something like that, but not arbitrarily hard. So that, at any rate, is sort of the division, and as I say, well, it's a toy model. So let me summarize. So what we've done is just to get back the standard theory of CMB. We develop it, but in this close analogy with ADS-CFT, and I think that's sort of very suggestive, very interesting, that, I mean, this is a concrete framework that could work. Now, my focus was completely on the IR divergences. That's where I think we're able to do a good job, and we can fully characterize them. And I think that's what at least gives me a little hope there, that those have an interesting interpretation, which at least I have a piece of there, because they govern some of the scaling. But I think there might be more things to interpret it in terms of, you know, perhaps even directly into gravity theory and some sort of universality, stuff like that. That's at least what I think is interesting. And so what we're working on is try to do things, just do better, go beyond slow roll, do higher point functions and stuff like that. But obviously what we really want is, I mean, where's the string? Okay, thanks.